Okay. So the reason why I was going to speak about Amal B'Torah really is just because it's the roots of it, or the source of it, as I wanted to present it, is in Pirashat B'Hukotai, in the Rashi in Pirashat B'Hukotai, which we already finished, and we already started reading Sefer B'Midbar, but I'm going to go back to that. But the truth of the matter is, given everything that we've spoken about over the weekend, over the Shabbat, I think that this is an important kind of addendum, cap, addition to it, right? So the likelihood is that you will hear me repeat some things that I've said, but I hope also that there'll be a bit more of a broadening, of an opening of one of the aspects that I presented. And that is that I suggested over the various talks, there was something that I was suggesting, maybe not outright, maybe yes, but maybe not as explicitly. And that is that we have a perception, at least in my experience, we have a perception that Torah is a bunch of information, right? And to study Torah is to study the information. And the more information of the Torah you know, the better. But I was suggesting that it's more than that. That the ideal aspect of Torah, the most important thing that Torah is for us, is that it provides for us a system of thought, a framework for thought that we use in order to be able to understand the world. So it is essentially the Torah that we use, meaning Klal Yisrael, Am Yisrael, we have traditionally used the Torah as a means for meaning, right? As a way to be able to understand and find meaning in the world. Now, before I take that further, I want to take a step back and talk about meaning for a minute, right? So I already established, I pointed out that meaning comes to us through contextualization, right? Creating context for things. But what does that mean? What does it mean that we create context for it? We have an illusion. I think that we have an illusion that unless we step back and recognize it, it's not something that we kind of have a sense of in our lives. And that is that the world itself, as it presents itself to us, is, I don't know, I hope this is, you know, the meaning of this word, is miscellaneous. You know what miscellaneous means? Yeah?
Miscellaneous.
Okay, good. Okay, same word. The world presents itself in a non-detail, in a non-meaning, right? Without meaning. It does not come with its own meaning. We provide the meaning. The world as it is has absolutely no meaning, right? There is nothing that tells us that, for example, what we call, again, I don't know what the Spanish word for this is, but what we call mammals, right? Mammalia. What is it?
Mammiferos.
Wonderful. Mammiferos. Right? What is that? These are animals that lactate, right? They have milk. They are animals that have fur or hair on their body, right? So what did we do? It's not like an animal comes to us and we look on the tag of the animal and says, "Hi, I'm a mammal." There's no such thing. It doesn't exist in its own sense. We saw that there were these animals that had similarities, right? They have similar characteristics. And that there are certain animals in this world that carry young and nurse young. And we decided that we're going to categorize these animals and call them mammals, as opposed to reptiles, as opposed to birds, and so on and so forth. All of that is us putting it on to the world. The world does not come with that meaning. So this is one of the things that in the history of philosophy, right, the discussions of philosophy, the existentialist philosophers were very big on pointing out. Because we were very used to recognizing that we see the world and automatically give it meaning. That's what human beings do. We are meaning-seeking beings, right? We tend to always need to be able to say what something means to us, however it is. What the existentialist philosophers pointed out, and they were not new in this, but they made it very well known, was that existence as it is, right? That's why they call them, thank you. That's what the, this is not, it's bottled water, yeah? Because I'm not, I'm just afraid I'm wrong. I just have to be careful. Not that I'm, you know, bougie that they say I'm not. Actually, yeah, the existentialists, the reason why they call themselves existentialists is because they wanted to look at existence as it is, as opposed to how it is that we overlay it, okay? I need you to bear with me here because I'm going to get a little bit deep, but to better understand the Torah. So I'm going to give you an example of this, okay, to give you a sense of what it is that I mean. Yeah, thank you. So let's say this was not a styrofoam cup. Let's say that this was a ceramic cup or a glass cup, right? And it fell on the floor and broke into a whole bunch of pieces. What would we call that? We would say it's a broken cup, correct? But when we say that it's a broken cup, we have in our minds that once it was a cup. Now, in which reality was it a cup? In my mind. In other words, my mind that knows a previous time, right, is able to overlay that time onto the current situation of broken pieces and call it a broken cup. So, meaning, in that sense, right, for me to, I just defined it. It's a broken cup. That's what I call it. That's what it means. That's what the definition is for me. But in reality, it's not a broken cup because the cup part never exists really. It doesn't exist in this current manifestation of the reality. You with me? Yeah? Doesn't. It only exists in my mind because I knew that it was what, and that's the only place that it exists because all that exists is what's happening right now. That's all that there is. So past and future are not real necessarily in terms of existential thought, right? If I'm looking at purely what it is that exists, what exists is what's happening as we are here now, conscious. If I, for example, I want to bake a cake. I put the cake batter, right? Pour cake batter into a pan. I don't know how familiar, some people are sure very familiar, some people not so familiar. But I put the batter of the cake in a pan. I'm familiar because my wife baked cakes. And I put it in the oven. I call that an unbaked cake. But it is not an unbaked cake. It is only an unbaked cake because I have an awareness that it will eventually become a cake. And I call it now an unbaked cake because I overlay my thought and meaning of how it is that I see this thing, what this thing means to me as to how it is that I present it. Yes? Okay. Now, what's important to recognize, why is that all important? Why am I sharing this with you? Is because the meaning of the world exists only in one place, in our mind. In the world itself, there is no inherent meaning. We put meaning. So what would the existentialist say? The existentialist would say there is no inherent meaning in the world, but we as human beings are wired in a way that we need meaning. So this is why Viktor Frankl, you know, you read Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, which if you have not read, I highly encourage you to read. I read it at least once every 2 years. If I were to say there's one essential book, non-Torah book that a person should read in one's life, it's that. And it's not a big book. It's a very important, very important book. You should read that book. But he points out, right, one of the things that he says is that we are meaning-seeking beings. He's not the only one who says this. We recognize this who we are. We do not do well with a miscellaneous world. We want to be able to understand and find meaning in things. It's the way that we, and with that we come. And that's why I said to you yesterday about the dreams, right? When you have an external sound and you incorporate it into the dream, it's the way that our minds work because we don't know what to do with undefined information. We much prefer to be able to have some meaning, even if it's the wrong meaning. We would rather have some meaning than no meaning onto things. So the existentialists say, well, you know, since that's the way that it is, you provide your own meaning. So Am Yisrael, don't do that. We do recognize that meaning exists in consciousness. We do recognize that. Am Yisrael, don't deny that. We recognize that meaning exists in consciousness. But what we believe, and this is part of our belief system, is that there is an ultimate consciousness. And that consciousness is God. We call him Tamim Deot, right? He is the all broad encompassing consciousness. And if there is consciousness for us, it is because it is a derivative of the ultimate consciousness. So that sounds like a very religious idea, but I have a, you know, I don't know if you've listened to my podcasts. I have a podcast series called Humans Being. And right now there's only 6 episodes because of the first season. I'm now recording the second season, but it's already been like 3 years, I think, since the first one. It's not my primary project. It's a side project. But I speak in those podcasts to various people in all, you know, sectors of life and work and discuss with them from a Torah perspective. And now you'll understand more why I do it at the end of this class. But I speak to them from a Torah perspective about their lives and what they do. What's their story and why it is that they do what they do and what is some of the meaning in terms of what it is that they do. Because I believe that the Torah, as you'll see at the end of this class, that the Torah has something to say about everything in the world, right? Not because it talks about everything. Explain. So one of the people that I spoke to in the series is a man named Donald Hoffman. Donald Hoffman wrote a book in English called The Case Against Reality. He's a scientist. He's a very substantial scientist. He's not a cuckoo scientist. He's a very substantial scientist. And he suggests that the entirety of the world as we perceive it is not the way that it is. That it is really, it presents itself to us because we see it and interact with it as a user interface. I'll explain what I mean by that, right? So if you have, for example, on your phone, you have WhatsApp. It's an example, right? You have WhatsApp. Where is the WhatsApp on your phone? There's a little square, green square, right? With a talk box, right? You touch that and that's WhatsApp. And you open that up and the chats come up and you talk to people and so on and so forth. But the thing is that we know, we don't think of it this way, but we know deep down, right, that that's not, that little green square is not the app. The app is code, right? In the phone, right? It's however it is that the code functions. I don't know how the code functions, but I know that it is code. But I know that if I were to engage with the app directly with the code, I would never text anybody, which maybe is a good idea, but I would never text anybody. What happens is it presents to us a user interface that makes it easier for us to be able to interact with the code. Yes? That's what it is. That's what it's not actually, that little green square is not the WhatsApp. It's just a user interface to help me engage with whatever it is that the app is. So Donald Hoffman is suggesting that the entirety of the world is that. And that evolutionarily, the way that our brains developed, and that for that matter, the rest of the animals on the planet in various ways, was to be able to engage with the code of reality, however it is, we have no idea what it actually is, right? And this includes, in other words, part of the user interface is time and space. That's part of the user interface, right? That it allows for us to be able to engage with reality in a much more efficient way. That if we were to engage in reality as it is, we would die because we wouldn't be able to deal with the complexities of it in a meaningful way. Are you with me? Okay. So why am I bringing up Donald Hoffman? Because he suggests that, well, then what is the fundamental nature of reality? And he suggests, contrary to others who believe that consciousness is an emergent property of the interactions of the brain, right, of the neural activities of the brain, he suggests that the fundamental nature of reality is consciousness. He calls them conscious units, right? So not consciousness in the way that we know it, but the building blocks of consciousness. That's the fundamental nature of reality. And he believes, you should read the book, but he believes that the fundamental reality, right, the fundamental building blocks of reality are conscious particles. Conscious particles. These aren't particles that are conscious of themselves in the way that we understand consciousness. There is bigger and broader elements of consciousness, but the basic substance, if you will, of reality is consciousness. And that it manifests in broader and more complex developed ways. And he says in the mathematics, work it out. I'm not a mathematician, but if you want to listen, you don't have to listen on my podcast. When you listen on my podcast, it's easier to access. But he has very good discussions with Sam Harris about this, and I suggest that you read his book. Again, it's called The Case Against Reality by Donald Hoffman. Ekshe, I'm saying this to you because consciousness is, for us, where meaning lies. It does not lie outside. It lies inside. But what I'm also suggesting is that as far as we are concerned, as far as Israel is concerned, traditionally, in our understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is that he's also consciousness. He is the ultimate consciousness. And the reason I'm mentioning Darul Hoffman is because really all HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is it's just consciousness. It's just a matter of how it is that consciousness manifests in a user interface. So all of this essentially is illusory, our experience, right? It just helps us engage with what's actually there. So if that's the case, then meaning for us does not only exist in our mind, but in his. And that's what Torah is for us. Torah is the presentation of a particular system of meaning of the world that comes from that consciousness. Now, granted, if you deny that, yes, you deny that. Then you, but there are only two ways of looking at it, I'm saying. You either recognize it that way, or you recognize it in the existentialist way. Everything else is nonsense. Everything else is nonsense. It's either Bilam, I'm going to say why Bilam, I'll explain to you why, right? But I mentioned him before. It's either him or Abraham. There's nothing else. Which is why the Hachamim, when they, in the Mishnah, for some reason, doesn't make sense when you look at it on the surface, they compare Abraham to Bilam. Why? And Moshe. But Moshe is only an outgrowth of Abraham. Moshe doesn't stand on his own. Moshe is only Moshe because of Abraham Avinu. Harambam writes that explicitly. I quoted you Harambam in the Avodah Zarah, in the end of Avodah Zarah. He says, Mishvat Hashem, right? Me'avat Hashem otam, shvat Hashem shba'al Abraham Avinu, asa Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is only an extension of Abraham Avinu. Everything is an extension of Abraham. But the only two ways of looking at the world realistically are that. You either look at it as an existentialist and recognize that they're absolutely right. The existentialists, if you remove God, and I'm not saying anyone has to or should, but if one does, then you have to understand what it is that it means to do that. Well, if one removes God, what you're essentially removing is an external consciousness of the world. All you've got outside of that is you. That's all there is. Because I have no way of knowing what anybody else is thinking or experiencing. The only thing that I have is my own consciousness. That's all that I've got in my life. And if that's the case, then all I have is the meaning that I put onto the world. But what I do, what the reality is at the bottom of all of that, which is why the existentialists were a bunch of lunatics, right? They were. They were great. They were nuts, right? They had crazy lives. That was not easy. It's because at the bottom of it all, when I'm half asleep in my bed at night at 4 a.m, is that I realize that there is absolutely no meaning. And that includes my own life. And that the only meaning that there is what I conjure up to put onto it, but it is not essentially meaningful. And that is the only other option that we have outside of God. Now, I'm not saying because of that believe in God. I believe in God. I believe in God because of my experience of life, but that's me, right? It's not because I'm a rabbi. It's not because I'm a rabbi. Hafuch, it's the opposite, right? The belief in God came first. If you have a rabbi who believes in God because he's a rabbi, you should be careful. But that's not... The only other option that we have is that there is an ultimate consciousness and that is ultimately what it is that provides any kind of meaning in the world at all, right? So what it is that we believe the Torah, and all I'm saying is, right, I'm not trying to prove this to you. I don't want to prove to you God or the Torah. That's not my job. I'm expecting that if you're here, you either hold of it or you don't hold of it. I'm simply talking to you within the system. How do we understand it? I'm presenting you what it is that the thought within the system is. So if I understand, when I speak about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ultimately what I'm talking about is the ultimate consciousness of all things, right? The ultimate being of all things, right? So it's not, God in this sense is not something that exists. God is. If we could say such a thing, the very nature of existence itself. Really, he's a precursor to existence. He's not even, right? Existence is a created element. Which is why our name for HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Yod Ke Vav Ke. Because if you think about it, that name expresses being. Because in Hebrew, how do you say to be? Lehiyot. Right? Haya, Hoveh, Yeh. Those are all words of being. God's name is the name that expresses being, existence. So what we recognize Torah to be, our understanding of what Torah is a presentation of a system of meaning on the world that we, in which we live our lives. Who's we? Us, Am Yisrael. We don't expect that anybody else needs to accept that meaning. It's our meaning. It is how we essentially see the world. Now, if that's the case, it is one of the reasons why Torah is not presented to us as pre-tailored solutions. Because the nature of the world is quite complex and dynamic. And therefore, what the Torah presents to us are not finite elements of meaning, but systems of creating meaning. In other words, it gives us frameworks in which we can discover meaning and definition. So no matter what it is that you look at in the Torah, you don't have anything that is actually practical in the Torah. It's very difficult, right? The example that I give all the time is Kabed et avicha ve et imecha, right? It's a very famous mitzvah, one of the Ten Commandments. Well, it seems simple enough, you know? How complex does it have to be? Honor your mother and father. Okay, well, the first question you can ask is, well, what is honor? How do I know that that is what it is that I'm fulfilling if I say the honor? What is honor? Is it what they want? Is it how I experience as the child? What I think honor is? Is it both? And what is Abicha Ve'imecha? What if I'm adopted? Are that my parents? Is it only biological parents? What about surrogates? Surrogacy, right? What if somebody's holding the egg of someone? Those are important questions. Whose parent? That also has to be defined. And that's the way that every single mitzvah is. There is not one mitzvah that does not require some definitions, right? Applications of how, what does this actually mean in our current context of life? But there is one thing that we cannot deny. And that is that there is a concept of honoring parents that we cannot dissociate from. The Torah demands that we figure out how we're going to deal with that. But we can't pretend that it doesn't exist. Honoring parents is an element of meaning that the Torah presents to us. You with me?
So there's existentialism inside the Torah?
Absolutely. The Torah recognizes the value of Bil'am very much. It's why the Gemara in Bava Batra, it says, Moshe Rabbeinu, listen to this, that's crazy Gemara. There's a sugya in Bava Batra that says, who wrote every book in the Tanakh? So it says, Moshe Katab Sifro, I mean, obviously understanding that it's Nebu'ah, V'sefer Bil'am. So it looks at Parashat Balak as its own thing. And that Bil'am is a special guy, right, in the Torah. So for the Hakamim to be able to say things like, I'm sure you've heard these midrashim before, but to say things like that, at the end of the Torah it says, "Velo kam Navi b'Yisrael k'moshe." There was no Navi that came up in Yisrael k'moshe. What did they say, Hakamim, on that? B'Yisrael lo kam. In Yisrael, but ba'umot kam. Bil'am ben Be'or Shemo. Bil'am is equal to, and it says, in the midrash it says that in philosophy, b'filosofia, they use the word philosophia. They say that Bil'am was a greater philosopher than Moshe Rabbeinu. But they say the difference between Moshe and Bil'am is that Moshe could talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu whenever he wanted. Bil'am had to wait for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to talk to him. But the level of their Nebu'ah was very much similar. What are you talking about? Why should that be? And the reason that is because Bil'am was not an Avodah Zarah worshiper. He was a nothing worshiper. He recognized that God was God. He acknowledged God. He wasn't an atheist. But he believed, why should God have a special relationship with anything? He's God. Why would, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, right? Why would God lock himself into a particular relationship, which requires, if you're going to be in a relationship, you have to compromise on some level your freedoms. You have to care about this person, act in a way that is sensitive to this person, commit faithfully to the relationship over a course of time, and so on and so forth. Free people don't do that, right? You know, utterly free people, they're free. Why would I lock myself into anything? So he didn't believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would ever do something like that. Completely did not believe that. And so he was, look, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is paying attention, so I'll go. That's why he says, I'm going to go and do this for you, but I can only say what HaKadosh Baruch Hu lets me say. So he calls Hashem Adonai Eloha, Yod Kevavke. He knows exactly who he's talking about. He didn't have any of this nonsense of Avodah Zarah. But he also didn't believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu cared about what he was doing. Why would he? He's God on me. I'm a little, you know, flesh and blood, nothing, biped on a little planet in the middle of nowhere. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to care about what I'm doing, what I'm having for lunch? He doesn't care what I eat or who I sleep with or what is going on. What does he care about? He's creating. He's creative. What does it matter? And on a certain level, he's absolutely right. Why would we expect that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is paying attention to these things? And what shatters Bilam is that he recognizes that as far as these people are concerned, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has some crazy desire to be connected to them. And he left broken because he did not expect that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would actually bind himself for the sake of love. And that's the one thing that Moshe Rabbeinu says to Bnei Israel. The one thing Moshe Bnei Israel says to about Bil'am is this. You should know, Moshe says to them at the end of his life, in Devarim, he says, you should know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't interested in listening to Bil'am. Why? Because he loves you. And to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, love is more important than anything. The sharing of existence is more important to him than anything. And Bilam didn't take that into account. We take that, as I said, to the bank. We, that is the source of everything. We believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us and that he's committed to us, and therefore it's only for us to be able to be committed to him. So what do we do in our covenant? We accept his Torah. And what is his Torah? His Torah is a presentation of his offering of a system of meaning to our lives. Now you question the value of that system of meaning? Well, look what it's done for us and for the world. I mean, it's a little bit nuts. It's crazy if you think about it. First of all, what it's done for us, like I said, the fact that it's held us through time up until now is no small thing. I tell this story often. You probably have heard me say it, but I'll repeat it briefly. There was a man in London, his name was Jack Lunzer. And Jack Lunzer was the owner of the largest collection, privately owned collection of Hebrew books in the world. And his collection spanned 1,000 years. He had books that crossed over 1,000 years. It was called the Val Madonna Collection. And he brought the collection to New York in 2005 to Sotheby's auction house because he was getting old. And he wanted to sell the entirety. It was millions and millions of dollars. And everybody went to go see this. It was the major Jewish event, you know, like the Val Madonna collection came to New York and so on. So I went to go see it. And it changed me because I recognized something that I knew, but I really didn't consciously realize. I walk into Sotheby's auction houses, these massive rooms, huge ceilings. And in every one, three huge rooms with huge ceilings, every one of these rooms, from floor to ceiling are books and books and books. And how is it displayed? And this is the key thing. You could display the books any number of ways, right? You know, how are you going to categorize them? Again, what's the meaning? How do I look at this? You could do it by author. You could do it by subject. You could do it by year. How did they present the books? By country in which they were written or published. And I'm telling you, from A to Z, there was not a country on this planet that wasn't represented there, kimat, almost. And you realize that, you realize there is not a place on this planet that we have not lived. There's not a language that we have not spoken. There's not a philosophy that we haven't absorbed into our national mindset. And all of that has changed. You speak Spanish, I speak English, they speak French, whatever. All of that changes. You eat, what do you have for breakfast? Chilaquiles. You eat that. Everybody eats different things. They have pancakes. All of that changes. There's one thing that has been with us throughout all of it, the Torah. It's the only thing that has been with us throughout all of it. So you question the nature of this system of meaning and how it is that it has supported us and helped us. Do not underestimate it. Whether you accept it, you don't accept it, you believe it, you don't believe it, don't underestimate what it actually has done. not to mention what is done to the rest of the world. The influence of the Torah on Western thought is unfathomable. It's hard for us to imagine what a world would be without it. But again, like I said the other night, think about what we're talking about. We're talking about a little book that really, what on earth is it? It's like, that's nuts. So that's the Torah. That is the system of meaning that we have accepted. And we believe that on whatever level we believe, that it comes from the consciousness of God for us. So it's not just our consciousness. Now, if it's a meaning that is coming from the source of all being, that tells me something. And this may very well be the source of our perpetuation, of our ability to get through. Because when we are in bed at night at 4 a.m, we recognize that I may understand things, I may not understand things, my meaning might be helpful, may not be helpful, but at the end of it all, meaning is something fundamental because it's in God. It's not something that I manufacture simply on my own, but it is what I share with Him. And so that brings me to Amal Torah. What is Amal Batorah? So the Rashi on the opening of Bechukotai, the Pasuk says, "In Bechukotai telechu v'tzmotai tishmeru v'asitem otam." If you walk in my chukot and you keep my mitzvot and do them. Incidentally, I want to point out over here, this is not the Amal Torah bit, I just want to point out, it says, "Mitzvotai tishmeru v'asitem." "Ushmartem v'asitem otam," it says in Parashat Ekeb. Yeah? Notice there's two things it talks about when it comes to mitzvot. It talks about shmirah and asiyah. And they're not the same. When I say to somebody, are you shomer Shabbat? That's not what I mean. Usually when I ask somebody if they're shomer Shabbat, I ask them, do you do Shabbat? Not do you shomer Shabbat. Shemirat Shabbat and shemirat mitzvot is not the same thing as doing Shabbat, doing mitzvot. Shemirah literally means to protect. To keep. To protect mitzvot is not a matter of doing them. To protect mitzvot is creating and holding the environment in which they're able to manifest. That's what to keep them means. To watch them. That's what it means. To do them is, I say kiddush, I don't, I don't cut my hair, I don't light fire, I don't, whatever it is. Yeah, that's the doing. So the Torah speaks about two things. Shmartem means protect it. Asitem means do it. And the two are not the same. They're two different aspects. But it also says, Bechukotai telechu. And the Hachamim very accurately point out, Rashi brings this, right? It's not Rashi, he brings it from the Sifra, like I said. He says like this, Yachol ze kiyum ha-mizvot. It says, Im Bechukotai telechu, Yachol ze kiyum ha-mizvot. Could Bechukotai telechu be talking about actually upholding the mitzvot? Kshu omer ve'et mitzvotai shmiru asitem otam hare ze kiyum ha-mizvot. It says, keep and do my mitzvot. That's keeping the mitzvot, doing the mitzvot. So then if that's the case, what's Bechukotai Telechu? Im ken, mani mekayem im Bechukotai Telechu, shtiyu amelim batorah. That you should toil, you should work in Torah. What is that? And what I'm suggesting to you is that the Amal Torah is the understanding and the development of meaning in the study of Torah. What does that mean? It means it is the work in building for ourselves the framework of meaning through which we understand the world. And in order to do that, it requires real toil in Torah. It requires real study and understanding and unpacking and comparing and detailing. That's what Amal Torah is. And that's what we're missing in the world today. Because the majority, even the most right wing, right, they can sit in kollel for years and years. But is it an amassing of information, or is it a building of a framework of thought that allows us to understand the entire world? Because that's what Amal Torah is meant to be. Outside of that, it's just a matter of knowing how to keep and do the mitzvot. So I to develop this, you want to understand this more, I gave a class, somebody was telling me that they listened to it, I'm sorry, I forget who it was, that I gave a class in the introduction of the Ramchal's Mesirat Yesharim. But the Ramchal wrote the Mesirat Yesharim twice. He was a playwright, the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. He wrote plays. So he was very fond of writing discourse in terms of dialogue, right? Presenting ideas in terms of dialogue. And he writes the Mesilat Yesharim as a dialogue, not the one that you know, right? There. By the way, the one, what is it? The Vikuach, the Ma'amar Vikuach. Was it you who told me that you listened to it? No, not you. So the Ma'amar Vikuach is an argument between a Hacham and a Hasid. And he does it brilliantly because at the beginning you think the Hacham is the hero. And it turns out that the tables flip and the Hasid becomes the hero and the Hacham learns from the Hasid. He has to the Hasid to teach him. But the introduction of that version is much more elaborate. And the essence of the introduction is this. Because he says to the Hacham, the Hasid, he says, you know, you study all of the mitzvot, right? You study everything. And you study all the details of the mitzvot. And it's years and years and years. Of course, you can study Hilchot Lulav forever, right? To understand all of the details of it. He says, but ultimately, what is the obligation of us in our lives? And how it is that we interact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the world for that matter? Do you study that? And he says, no, it's evident. Oh, that's evident, he says. That's evident. But the laws of Lulav and Etrog is not, you have to spend everything. But this is not evidence, the most important. And he goes through a whole discussion. What I'm saying is, the ultimate nature of Torah for us is not just to tell us what the mitzvot are and how we do them. It's to be able to have a system of thought through which I understand the world. And in that system of thought, and this is, if you hear one thing from me today, it's this, so please pay attention. In that system of thought that we call the Torah, there is nothing in this world that we cannot see through it and absorb and understand with it. That's why I have my podcast. I want to talk to everybody. I don't care if it's fashion. I have one where I talk about this woman who's a fashion. She developed a whole fashion thing that in which she presents algorithms for people based on their psychology and how it is that they shouldn't get. Whatever, I had a whole discussion with her about the psychology of fashion and why these things are important to us. I said to her, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the first fashion designer. Right? He made clothes. It tells us about Vayaso Kotnot Or. Okay? What about the design of the Kohen Gadol and his beautiful design? There's nothing that is silly. Because if you're talking about a system of meaning and it exists in the world, it comes from a Kadosh Baruch. Like I said, there are things that are toxic for us in the world. But even the toxins, we need to know how they make us sick and why. It doesn't mean that we have to eat them. But we have to understand what it is. And sometimes in toxins, there are things that are medicinal. So if we say, nah, it's all, what we're doing is we're taking the Torah and we're shrinking it and putting it onto the bottom. We're not looking at the grand, broad nature of the Torah. And I'm saying to you, and I'm suggesting to you that the Torah has within it the capacity to be able to have sophisticated dealings with everything in life. If you study the Talmud, that's why it's shocking to me. You know, people sit, they study the whole Talmud. Anybody who even studies the Talmud in a basic, superficial way cannot deny the fact that the Hachamim are comfortable talking about everything. There's nothing the Hachamim don't talk about. If it exists in this world, the Talmud discusses it. Openly, clearly, easily, but there's one unique aspect of it. It deals with it from a Torah perspective. That's why I tell people, I'm an advocate of studying Daf Yomi. People suggest that it's silly to study Daf Yomi. What are they going to remember? Nobody remembers anything. I don't care if you remember anything. But there's one value of it. When you study the Talmud every day, and you read the discourse and discussions of the Hachamim every day, you start to think like them. You get used to their thinking and talking. You become part of that world. You plug in to the mindset that is the framework of Torah. And then you realize that there's nothing in this world that you can't discuss. So why is it that the Hachamim say, for example, you're not allowed to read certain books? They do say that. Not allowed to read certain books. It's very simple why. Because what I'm talking to you about, how many of us do that? How many of us study the Torah that way? We don't. Now, it's important to realize, I don't expect that everybody should now get out and start learning the Torah that way. It's not easy. You have to dedicate yourself to learning. This is amal, right? Amal is, you have to roll up your sleeves and die in the study of this in order to be able to genuinely have it become a framework and system for us. Like any other system of thought that was going to be that important for us. It's for this reason that the Hachamim say, Aseh lecha rav, which literally just means, establish for yourself a master. That's what rav literally means. It's a master. In what sense? There's apprentice and there's master. And what is the goal of the master? What's the point of a master? The master has the whole system mastered, right? We say he's got it right. And the apprentice does not. So the apprentice, in his relationship with the master, is able to fill in with that connection what he does not have. Now that's very dangerous sometimes, right? Because you don't have a good master, he'll manipulate the apprentice. Or if you have an apprentice who doesn't know how to choose a master, he could choose the wrong one. But the concept is a very important concept because it's saying, we recognize that the Torah is a system of thought. And we, as average people, may not be masters of the system, but we want to live within the system. And that's why for us, the Hachamim were very important because they were masters of the system. And they presented frameworks for us to help us be able to live and understand the system, even if we didn't always understand why or what it was. Does that take trust? Yes. Are there pitfalls with that? Yes. And the Torah is filled with those stories of pitfalls and failures. But ultimately, there's no other options. I mean, I watched, I said, you know, I saw Stephen Hawking. You know Stephen Hawking. I watched his students, how they were acting with him. I've seen anything. The only time that I've seen anything like that is Talmidim with their rabbi. They listen to every word that he's saying. They support him. They serve him. And it's not just because he's handicapped. I've seen it happen with other scholars. When you have scholars of high caliber that are holding a system of knowledge that is meaningful to the students, they recognize it's not just about sitting in class and taking notes. It's about being in the environment of how this person sees the world. And so we either engage in developing that and achieving mastery, or we connect with masters and build ourselves as much as we can within that system, but we understand one thing. The Torah is not just Shmirat and Asiyat Mitzvot. It's Bechukotai Telechu. And Bechukotai Telechu, as Achamim says, Amal Torah. And Amal Torah is engaging in understanding the world through the framework of Torah. So when I say it's important to study Shakespeare or the Beatles or whatever it is that you want to look at and study a part of the world, there's a caveat to that. It's not just that you should read everything that's out there. The goal is to understand it through the framework of Torah. And if you can understand it through a framework of Torah, there is nothing in this world that is out off limit, and there's nothing in this world essentially that is not part of Torah. So for example, I was saying, the Hachamim say you can't read books of Avodah Zarah. Why can't you read books of Avodah Zarah? Because the Hachamim were very concerned. If you do not have a full system of understanding, that will become the system of your understanding. We're very vulnerable. We're very vulnerable to thought. That's another thing that's important for us to understand as human beings. We are profoundly vulnerable to thought. When we tell people, think for yourself, we never mean think for yourself. We mean stop thinking like those people and start thinking like these people. Because we don't think for ourselves as human beings. We always think in the collective system. So the Hachamim want us to, yeah.
In that case particularly, why did the Hachamim say that whoever reads these books, Elo Helik Olamaba?
Because he's saying, the Hachamim are saying, that if you're going to look at these books to explore possibilities of thinking, Elo Helik Olamaba, because you are removing yourself from a system that is bringing you towards Olamaba.
It's a problem.
What is it?
It's a
big problem. It's a?
It's probable.
Probable, right.
It's going to happen.
Yes, correct. And yet, well, I'll tell you the cases that we recognize it didn't, for example, right? So there's a rule, right? What happens if a person worships Avodah Zarah? In the old days, right? When there was a court system and punishments and so on and so forth. What happens if a person worships Avodah Zarah? It's punished. But on what? When is a person punished? When they worship the Avodah Zarah in the way that those people who are of the Avodah Zarah worship it. So if he worships Avodah Zarah in a weird way that's not the way the Avodah Zarah worship, it's Asur, but he's not Hayav. They can't kill him, right? They can't punish him. So that's a problem. Why? Because if he comes to court, what does the court need to determine? Whether the person worshipped the Avodah Zarah in the way the Avodah Zarah is. How are they going to know this? They don't read the books. No, the Sanhedrin did. The Sanhedrin had to know all of the intricacies of the Avodah Zarah so they could know whether I'm going to punish this person because he worshipped that. Why weren't we worried? Because they were the Sanhedrin. That's why. We weren't worried. I was talking to a very good friend of mine, an author. His name is Mark Helprin, who's brilliant. He's a brilliant man. And I was saying to him, I'm going to the coronation. And I told him, I'm not loving that I have to go to church on Shabbat to be, in the course. And it really did. I didn't like being there full of the Yeshu, everything with Yeshu. But he wrote back to me, he goes, don't worry, I don't think you're a likely convert. Meaning you're not going to go and be converted by the... Okay, so that's the broad... When the Hachamim spoke, they spoke to the broad Am. And they were very responsible. Look, don't do this. Why? Because you do... You don't realize how susceptible we are to the things that we read and take in. We don't have high levels of scrutiny in terms of being able to test what it is that we're taking in. We are very easily susceptible. Yeah? So those are examples, right? Those are things that we recognize. But at the same time, we understand that possibility is that the Torah provides for us a framework to be able to understand anything in the world through its way. So yes, there is a side of orthodoxy that is very worried about the toxins. And I don't think that they're completely wrong. But they also have to recognize that there's an element of humanity that we cannot divorce and erase. We can't stop being human beings. We have to be able to recognize this is who we are, this is the world that we live in, we have certain things that are just part of our nature. And that the value of our derech, of our system, is that we have this amazing Torah that is capable of discussing all of these things on a very deep and meaningful level. So when I said, for example, that Chacham Shaul Morterah, who was the rabbi of Spinoza, didn't know how to deal with Spinoza, it's because his Amal Torah had not brought him to that place yet of having to deal with the things that Spinoza was raising. Because nobody thought about it yet. But it's not because the Torah is not capable. And you say, how is it? Where does it say that? And the point is, it's not that it says, this is how you answer Spinoza. It gives you principles. And that goes back to the idea of why principles are so important. Because in the Amal Torah, in the working through Torah, you use the principles and you discover new developments of those principles. That's what we call Hidush. Right? And the Hachamim say, "En bet midrash belo Hidush." You can't really study and not have new thoughts and ideas from what you study. It's not about, or you're not studying. You're not studying. If you're really studying and you're really developing and opening up, you're always going to have new understandings and new openings of how it is that we understand the world. But how beautiful that is. Why should we shrink the Torah into being some parochial dogma when the Torah is capable of being this expansive, broad system of understanding and thought that rivals the greatest systems of thinking? And that's, if you ask me, the thing that I am most worried and concerned about is that we are losing this recognition of what Torah is. And it's a huge difference. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be that way for us. It's exciting. You know, the Hachamim say a beautiful midrash, and I think that everybody quotes this midrash the wrong way. It says, for Talmidei Hachamim, Torah is like water. And it says it's like the fish in the sea. The fish in the sea, they're all water. All they have is water. But when it rains, they all come up to the rain. Like, yani, they don't have enough water, they have to come up to the rain. So how do most people explain that midrash? They just want more. That's not, I don't understand that to be the midrash. New water. It's fresh. There's something new. And that's how real Talmidei Hachamim see Torah. You have something, a hidush, something new, something different, something that I haven't considered before. Maybe there's something here. And that's, for me, what Torah is. It's a never-ending excitement and discovery and understanding. And that's what Torah was also for Rambam. It's what it was. And it's what it's been for so many. And this is not a Sfaradi Ashkenazi thing. There were great Ashkenazi Hachamim who saw the Torah like this. And that's why it says in Pirkei Avot, it says the Torah is a keli hemda. It's a precious keli. What's a keli? A vessel. It's a tool. It's something that we use in order to be able to find meaning in the world. And there's very few things that provide meaning for us that the way that the Torah does. It's beautiful that way. Yeah, that's basically what I wanted to share. Yeah.
Wow. Can you give a few examples of this meaning that the Torah gives to the world, especially if you can give the most important example?
I'll give you an example. For example, with regards to, let's take Pirkei Avot as an example. What is Pirkei Avot? Pirkei Avot, people think that the definition of Avot is fathers. It's not fathers. Avot is, again, it's principles. Right? Like it says, the things that are asur to do on Shabbat are 39 Avot melachot, haser ahad, Avot. Right? Or the nizikin, arba'a Avot nizikin. There are four broad, Av in that sense is a broad category. Right? Pirkei Avot are pirakim of Avot. Of principles. The whole of Pirkei Avot are principles that the Achamim presented to us. So what are they telling us? In Pirkei Avot, they're telling us principles for life that we find meaning with. Right? So when it says, Ha'aminu Talmidim Harbeh. Why Ha'aminu? That's a principle. Why Ha'aminu Talmidim Harbeh? What is the meaning in that? Well, there's many reasons why we say Ha'aminu Talmidim Harbeh. Why? Because if you sit and think about your things, it's nice. But if you start to teach students, everyone is a different mind. And so like it says, Rabbi Hanan says, he goes, Harbe Torah lamati merabotai, mehavera yoter, mitalmida yoter mekulam. I learn from my students more than anybody. Why? Because they're asking me questions and they keep me thinking and developing and opening and presenting. So all of those things, what am I giving you? I'm giving you an example. I'm giving you one principle. But look what the possibilities of that principle are. Right? Or you say, for example, Hevu mitunim badin. The Hachamim say, pause. Matun means pause, wait. Like in Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, we say tamtin. Tamtin means wait, 1 second. Hevu mitunim means pause when you're having to make judgment. What does Rabbeinu Avadia Bar Tanura say about Hevu mitunim badin? Rabbeinu Avadia Bar Tanura says, if something comes to you and you've seen it once, twice, three times, don't say, Kvar ra'iti et zeh. Don't say, I've already seen it once, twice, three. Maybe there's something new here. That's a principle. It teaches you how it is that you should start thinking about the world. So you go through all of it and you recognize that there are all of these principles. So all of them is both. The fact that we look at the parashiyot of the Torah, the stories of the Torah. Why did Abraham say this? Why did Yaakov do this? Why did Rachel do the things that she did? All of those questions are so important. Why? They're important to us because they teach us about behaviors, about relationships, about concepts, about ideas and interactions and how it is that we manifest them. That's how we look at Torah. That's why it's not just here, let me give you a Dvar Torah and tell you a nice thing, right? There's a whole system. I read these stories and I recognize that they are presenting me with a mode of engaging in the world. And so that's the way that we look at it. That's the way that we think of it. So if I have a whole system being able to think that way and understand what are the themes of Parashat Noah? You look at the parashah that way. Look at every parashah that way. When the Hachamim said, read this much, because there was two opinions as what to read, right? Once in 3 years you finish it or once in 1 year. So you finish in 1 year. The Hachamim said, begin here, end here. Why do they do that? Because they recognize that there's a theme here that we can look at and consider it. Good, so I look at it that way. I start to think about the Torah, not in terms of what it is that I need to do or not do, or what's right or what's wrong in terms of my behavior, but I start to look at themes of thought that inform me as to how it is that I should relate to the world. So I look at Parashat Noah, Migdal Babel, it says, V'chol ha'ar safa ahadu dvarim ahadim. The whole world was one language, everybody was doing everything the same way. What do you think? That's wonderful, that's phenomenal. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't think it was phenomenal. He goes down and says, well, we've got to stop this. We've got to break them apart. We're going to change everything around. What on earth? Why? And still, right? There's one Ma'amar HaChamim says that's why the punishment was less for them, because at least they were unified. But it was bad unity, because they didn't allow for the diversity in the unity. I give you 100 examples of, but the point is, how am I looking at it? I look at it as not just a bunch of stories that I want to know or a Dvar Torah here or there. I want to be able to look at it as a presentation of systems of thought, belief, and action in my life. That's the best I could do for you now. Yeah.
What I understand is that you say that we need to study, like, it's good for people to study that you mean. Maybe it's because there's a possibility, just as there is a possibility for them, if they study Sifrat Minut, to have that ideas. Maybe it's also, there's a good possibility to for them, if they study Daf Yomi,
yes,
to have good ideas.
I think it's more than a possibility.
Not necessarily that there is a malat batorah, but...
No, I'm saying that the study of Daf Yomi, it trains your mind to think in that way. Without realizing it, you'll start to be very familiar with the way the Hachamim think about things.
Like,
and that's valuable. I personally think it's valuable. I think it's valuable.
Like, for example, Chabad read Rambam every day.
Yes.
But not necessarily think,
yes,
like...
I don't think that that's true. I mean, look, we don't agree with... I don't agree with everything a Chabad says. Mm-hmm. Or does. They're a pretty powerful force in the Jewish world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that the Rebbe said... you should study Harambam every day because you know the whole Torah if you study Harambam. That was a good thing. I think it was a good thing. And it allowed for them, I believe, this is my own personal belief. Look, I believe there is nobody in the Jewish world that loves Klal Yisrael the way the Chabad does. I don't agree with them. A lot I don't agree with them. But there's one thing that they do. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, he said, Hitler went around the world as far as he could to find every Jew to destroy them and hate them. If he could do that, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, I could go around the world and find every Jew and love them. So Chabad, I don't agree with all of their philosophies and so on and so forth, but I'll tell you one thing. You show me one other group of Jews who loves Jews the way that Chabad loves Jews, and I will take my hat off to you. And I think that in no small part that has to do with the Rambam. Why? I'll tell you why. Because they learn the Rambam the way that they do, they have security in their Torah. And because they have security in their Torah, it gives them the freedom to love all of Klal Yisrael without worrying, I'm going to agree with them, not agree with them. Why do we not love everybody else? Because we don't like what they think. The Chabad don't care. They don't care what you think. They know what they think. They don't have, and they're not threatened by the way that you think. It created for them a very strong and sturdy system of thinking and belief. I think there are good things that come of it. I don't agree, like I said, with everything they do, but I think that's a good thing that they do.
You're saying security in Torah, like...
Meaning they have a clarity, they have a system of Torah that the Rambam presents to them that they learn every single day that provides for them a fortified framework of Torah and thought. And that's it. It's not the Rebbe alone. If it was the Rebbe alone, there would be big problems. The fact that the Rebbe included the Rambam in their daily learning was a huge, huge thing. And I think it really saved them. I think it did a huge thing for them.
Would you say like Daf Yomi will be like a Lecha Techilah option for?
No, it's different. It's different things. Harambam. If you study Harambam, you know what to do. You really have a very strong sense of the practical implications of Torah on a various level. Talmud. If you study Talmud every day, you start to think in terms of the Hachamim, which is a very high value. I think it's very, very important. But it's two separate. It's two different things. So I would, if you had the time, I would do both. I would do both.
Like for most people who do Daf Yomi or Balevatim, who doesn't study anything more than this, do you think that's...
I don't think it's bad. I think that they could perhaps maybe do a little bit more of other things, but I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's bad. I think it's a good thing. I think that that learning brings them into a world that is only helpful for them. It's nourishing. It's helpful. They may not do any very well with their lives or in the Jewish world and not understanding. If they're genuinely learning. In other words, if they're just doing a Daf Yomi just to get through the Daf because they think they get points in Shamayim for that, ze lo tov. If they're really paying attention to the learning, I think it's very valuable. It's possible to learn Daf Yomi and not learn. It's possible. It doesn't help. But if you learn Daf Yomi and you learn and you understand the discussions, and you go through, even don't remember them, but you understand them and you start going through them over and over again, it affects the way that you think. Yeah.
This Amal Torah concept, why so, well, I feel like it's so hard to reach.
It is.
And often with all the practical stuff and the mitzvot and how you do them and everything, I think is we get lost in that, and it's so hard to find the meaning.
Yes.
And also the information that we can get in the, I don't know, in the way Torah presented to us, I think it's very hard.
It is very hard. It is very hard. And I think that...
Now I'm thinking how I'm going to reach that. And
yeah.
I don't have an answer.
Yeah. I think that's the question. That's the question that everybody is probably asking. So I'm glad that you asked it. Yeah. I'm going to say, I think that we are in a crisis of meaning today. We're in a crisis of meaning today because we have broken down and are continuing to break down everything that gave us meaning in the world. And I say we, I don't mean the Jews. I mean humanity. And so we are in a tremendous meaning crisis. And the Jews are not immune from that. Because we think we are, but we are constantly influenced by everything around us. So in the same way that the rest of the world is doing their own thing and they're happy, we're also doing our own thing and we're happy. But what happens as a result of that is there is a crisis. And what used to be was that the average person lived within a system that provided meaning that they didn't have to do it themselves. Understand? In other words, the average person lived within a system that was providing, you know, a general system of meaning and thought. And it became the way that Jews think. You know, it just became the way we think without even realizing this is what we think. I admit to you that we are in a situation today in which it is extremely problematic. And it is not going to be easy for you, or maybe even possible. I don't want to give you, you know, despair, to be able to do this on your own. The reason why I'm sharing this with you is because I think it's important for you to know about it. Because otherwise you don't know what to make of what it is that's going on in the Jewish world. And I'm trying to differentiate, to show the differences. So we had great people, and we still do. I mean, we have books, and we have people that related to the Torah this way. I think that that's one of the reasons why we don't understand why, but we liked Rabbi Sachs very much. As an example.
That's what I was going to say.
Why?
Right,
so why did we like him? Right. But what the reason why people appreciated him, one of the reasons why people, he was a wonderful man and a good friend of mine, but one of the reasons, and we miss him terribly, but one of the reasons why we appreciated him is because Rabbi Sachs was able to use the system of Torah to make sense of the world for us. And that's something that we need. So there are people out there, I mean, there are still people out there, they may not be Rabbi Sachs, but there are people there that are able to do that. And I think that that's what it is that we need to look for. So if we're not doing it ourselves, we need to look for who's teaching. And how can I be able to kind of plug into that way of thought and be able to live my life in Torah in that way? That's what we can do. That's what we can do. Unless we want to really dive in and become one of the masters, which by all means, you know. But otherwise, it's a matter of who is presenting Torah to us in this way. And I'm not the only one. There's other people out there. But that's what we want to try and plug into and be able to build. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Thank you. Would you say that the breakdown in understanding Torah as a broad system of meaning started with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain? That was, for example, the emergence of Kabbalah as a new framework of meaning, and it also pushed another big chunk of Israel to just look at Torah's system of mitzvos. Would you say that it started with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain?
No, I wouldn't. I think that this was always a problem. I think this was a problem in the time of the Talmud. It was a problem. That's why the Hachamim spoke about it. There's always a danger of people using alternate systems to be able to think of things. Always. There's always a danger of people using alternate systems. And the challenge was always to bring people into the system of Torah and teach them that. I don't think personally that Kabbalah was an alternative system. I think that the people that... I'm talking about the Ari's Kabbalah. I'm not talking about the Spanish Kabbalists. I'm talking about the Ari's Kabbalah. What the Ari did with Kabbalah was reintegrate the thoughts of Kabbalah into the broad system and integrate it for all intents and purposes within Arambam because they were very concerned about Gashmiut and all of that kinds of things. And all I think is... I said this to some people the other day. Kabbalah is a perspective. It provides perspective, but I don't think that it teaches anything new. I think that people make a very big mistake, and there are Kabbalists that make mistakes. They don't know how to relate to it appropriately because they don't relate to it within the broad system of Torah. They don't look at it as part of the system. They look at it as its own thing. And when you look at it as its own thing, then yes, it's a tremendous breakdown, but that's not how it was taught. No, it's not how Rabbeinu Ari presented it. It wasn't how those Mikubalim put it forward. But because people didn't know how to understand, because really what Kabbalah is it's teaching very abstract concepts with abstract ideas and terms that people did not know how to practically absorb. It was very, very problematic. So people got stuck into the abstractions and did not know how to bring them down to practical realities. There were very few people who were able to do that. And so it ended up creating a problem. But I think that people have tremendous mistakes in how it is that they understand Kabbalah. They don't get the abstract ideas and how it is that they manifest in practical terms. So I don't think that was the big deal. I think that that's the problem of abstractions in general. People love to live in abstractions and they don't know how to bring those things into practical terms. And having nothing to do with Jews or Kabbalah. So, you know, people do that all the time with thought in general. So it's an issue. Yes.
When we say that Shivim Panim La Torah,
yeah,
or when we say that there are four levels of rank,
yeah,
this, how does this relate to all this that you explained about these different explanations or meanings of the
There's a way that I can kind of present it to you as perhaps a mashal, right? Because if we're looking at a system of meaning, right, when the Hachamim say Shivim Panim La Torah, basically, what they're saying is that there are subsets within, right? In other words, I can take a particular course of study. So if you take, for example, Hillel and Shammai, right? They had different schools. They had different ways of approaching things. To the point that even the practical halacha ended up coming out differently. And it was funny that Hillel kept coming to very similar conclusions and Shammai kept coming to very similar conclusions. You could tell that one was Shammai, one was Hillel. And what was the thing? One thing, the point was that each of them had a consistent approach of understanding Torah, right? They came into the Torah, they had a consistent approach of understanding Torah, and through that they were able to look at the world. So the way that I would explain that is, let's say that I want to, you know, I'm looking at, what would I be looking at? Let's say I'm looking at the Eiffel Tower, right? And I want to be able to sketch, or I want to be able to paint or represent the Eiffel Tower. Well, a lot will have to do with where it is that I'm standing in terms of my presentation of it. I'm standing from a building that's looking at it from, you know, a particular level, you know, above the ground perspective, right? Is it from the ground by looking at it? And I present it and paint it that way. My rendition may be very different from yours and yours and yours, but everybody will be able to recognize, I hope, right, that I'm painting, or you're painting, Eiffel Tower. It's still looking at and developing the same thing. It's just that the approach is different. The perspective is different. And those are the Shivim Panim. Or, for example, even if I say that there's different impressions, there's different modes of art, right? You do it in an impressionist. He does it in Renaissance. He does it in whatever. It does it a different way. But still, you can recognize that this is the Eiffel Tower, that they're all talking about the Eiffel Tower. So the Torah, in saying that there are Shivim Panim, is saying that there are 70 broad, right, consistent ways of looking at Torah that are equally acceptable and viable. The point is they need to be consistent. And we don't have that. We're not used to doing that anymore today, about studying something in a consistent fashion and looking at it in a particular school of thought. That's why I don't like when people say the Dvar Torahs. I don't like them. Why? Because they're just random thoughts that have, can I plug it back into to a way of thinking? Can you tell me something on the Pasuk? If I look at that on the Pasuk and put it back into the parasha, does it flow? Can you present the whole parasha to me this way? Oh, then beautiful. So then I love to hear. But if it's just some random idea that doesn't have anything to plug into, that's not meaningful. Because it doesn't have any consistency of context and system. So you see what I'm saying? So the Shivim Panim are various perspectives of looking at the same thing that are equally valid. It's just that a different way of looking. Which is what I'm saying about Kabbalah. That's what I'm saying about Kabbalah. I don't understand Kabbalah the way many people do. I look at Kabbalah and I spend many, many years studying Kabbalah. And I don't look at it say the Kabbalah doesn't teach new things. It looks at things from different perspectives and presents them in a way that we are not used to thinking based on the system that we
approach. In terms of the meaning that you spoke, that Torah, the Meluk Torah is, so that we get an understanding of a different meaning. How does it mean the 70 ways in terms of are they different meanings?
Yeah, they're different approaches. They're looking at things from a different perspective. I don't know that we can call them different meanings. I think that it will shed light. In other words, it'll give light on different parts in different ways. So you look at, I'll give you an example between the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi are both talking about the same Mishnah. That's what the Talmud is. It's talking about the Mishnah. It's the same Mishnah. They're not talking about anything Mishnah, but one is very different than the other. So what's the difference? The Talmud Yerushalmi, it covers up the developmental system, the developmental pathways that they used in order to be able to get to their conclusions. It tells you, this is the halakha. So it gives a Mishnah and it says, halakha aleph, bet, gimel, dal, on the Mishnah. On the Mishnah. And what is the major word of learning that the Talmud Yerushalmi uses? Ta hazeh. Come see. Look, here it is. Presented to you. Ready, finished, made.
The Zohar
also says, ta hazeh. The Talmud Bavli doesn't do things that way. The Talmud Bavli says, sit down. We have a question. Oh, okay, well, let's think about that question. Wait, I don't know. I don't like that question. What about this question? Or even if I answer your question, I don't like that answer. Maybe I like this answer. I ask a question. 4 pages later, maybe I got to a conclusion. And you have to go for a journey on all the whole thing. And how that comes in, tashema. Shema, you have to listen word after word after word after word until you end up developing, coming into a picture. It's a very different way of doing it. In English, we talk about it as bottom up or top down. I can do things two different ways, but it doesn't mean that one way is invalid and the other way is valid. It may be the way that I engage as opposed to the way that somebody else engages. The same thing about learning systems, right? Some people are very visual learners. Some people are auditory learners, yeah? Some people need to see the things in order to be able to get them. Some people need to listen to things in order to be able to get them. Does it mean that they don't know how to learn? No, it means that they do it in different ways and they're equally valid possibilities. Systems for being able to come to a recognition of and relationship to truth, to what it is. That's what I think brought.
Will it mean different things to different?
It may, but I think that it would not be so different that they would not recognize that it's part of the same corpus, right? That we share the same corpus. Yeah.
Do you think there is an intrinsic meaning in all of its work, and just don't have the right tools, logic to include the meaning that God really intended?
Again.
Or it was intentionally not given in the meaning, so everyone can get to their own conclusions for what they're living in the moment.
Yeah, no. I don't think the second thing. The Torah was given, the mitzvot were given in a very specific context. And the mitzvot need to be performed in that context.
No, performed, yes, but the meaning.
That's what I mean. They have to be performed with the meaning in terms of how it is Torah presented them. The meaning is very basic. You can get into deeper and deeper levels of meaning, but the meaning is very basic. HaKadosh Hu gave us mitzvot because he's in relationship with us, and he told us, here's how you serve me. If you do the mitzvot because of that, then you're great.
Yeah, that's the general
meaning. Yeah.
He does explain that in the Torah. The verses,
yeah.
He does say
yeah.
But the explicit or more specific meaning of each.
Yeah, so that you can unpack. You can unpack. Even Harambam, when he spends time giving reasons for the mitzvot, Harambam is not saying these are the emphatic reasons for the mitzvot. I'll prove to you that that's not the case. Right? Outside of the Mishpatim. Mishpatim are very obvious, right? They're self-evident. But I'm talking about the Hukim, right? That the Harambam gives all of these reasons for the Hukim. Harambam is never saying this is the reason of the Huk. I'll prove to you that that's that way. Harambam, he talks about the mitzvah of Shiluah HaKen. And he explains in the Moreh Nebuchim what's the mitzvah of Shiluah HaKen. It says it's rahamim. Why? Because if you're going to take the betzim, don't do it with the mother there. Send the mother away and then take the betzim because it's not nice. It's tzar ba'le hayim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hasa, cares about the feelings of the animals and how you should treat them. Okay. Then there's a halakha in the Mishnah that if a person gets up to the tefillah, he leads the tefillah and he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ad kan tzipor yagiu rahamecha. Your mercy, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, comes to the Kan Tzipor, comes to the nest of birds even, referring to the mitzvah of Shiluah HaKen. What do we do with that person? We kesh him off the teba. Why? Gezerat HaKatub Hu. You know what's the reason? You don't know what's the reason. Gezerat HaKatub. The Torah says so. You know why HaKadosh Baruch Hu said it? And Harambam is posek. That, like the Mishnah, in the Mishneh Torah, that if a person gets up and says, and yet in the Moreh Nebuchim, he says the reason for Shiluah HaKen is because Rahamim. So what I'm saying is, okay, I can say that's not the reason, But I don't know that that is the reason that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the mitzvah. I can't come into the mind of God. Yeah? So that, I recognize. So those kinds of things, it's fine. You can present what it is that you want to present. And that's why HaRambam says, Kol she'atayecho latet bo tam ten bo. Assign meaning to it. But don't think that your meaning is the intrinsic meaning to, what is it there? The intrinsic meaning is one thing. Mipnei ha'el shitzivaba. That's what Gezerat HaKatuv means, right? That's why when Harambami gives the reason for blowing shofar in Elchot Teshuvah, he says, "Af al pi shetekeat shofar Gezerat HaKatuv hu," right? Even though it's Gezerat HaKatuv, so don't think I'm going against Rem is Yeshbo. He says there's still, it hints to something. And this is what I think it is. So it's very important to recognize that.
Do you think it was intentionally placed so by God so there wouldn't be a specific meaning, so it would be a Torah that would apply for all ages?
Yes. I think it's more to it than that, but that's another shiur. But yes, in a sense, yes. Yeah, last question.
And it's whether it means or ends.
Means.
But what happened when the context changed?
What about it? What context?
Life.
Yeah, but the context of a mitzvah is always the same. It's always Avodat HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's always Brit and Avodat HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That never changes. How it is that we approach them, the meaning that we find, and so on and so forth, may develop in terms of the context of life, but the ultimate context is always the same. There's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's us, and there's that Avodah and Brit. And that runs throughout all of history. And that stays intact. The depth of it, the broadness of it, the nuances of it, that develops in terms of our life and our consciousness and the things that we know about the world. Of course, that can always develop. But the broad context of Brit and Avodah, Le'olam Olamei Olamim, it stands forever. Yeah. Okay. Okay, you walk me out. You walk me out.
It's more a comment than a question. How important that, I think this is in terms of the system that we are talking about. When now we are getting into the deepest recesses of matter,
yes,
knowing about the early stages of the universe and artificial intelligence and all.
We need to be able to deal with those.
Changing in a way that we don't even
absolutely
grasp of it.
Yeah.
Is it maybe, like you said yesterday, when things are challenged, is when you go and search for the where to hold on to?
Yeah.
It's now or never.
Yep, I'm with you.
I agree. That's why we're trying.